So in my talk, I present you some recent results which worked on in collaboration with Giuseppe D'Apollonio and Paolo Pani about the use of holographic methods in for investigating Einstein-Maxwell Wilson gravity. So this is the plan of my talk. So after some introductory remarks, I will give you the rudiments of the holographic ADST correspondence. I apologize for those of you who know it, but I will try to make a talk which is self-consistent. Then I'll move to what may be called the main application of this correspondence, which are the holographic superconductors. And then to the main part of my talk, which is the use of these methods to investigating Einstein-Maxwell gravity coupled to a scalar, non-minimally coupled to a scalar. There will be two parts, the investigation of finite temperature and the zero temperature limit. So it's fair to say that from the theoretical point of view, black holes are a magnifying glass into the realm of quantum gravity. So most of the recent crucial advances in the field have been triggered by black holes. I just mentioned two of them, the holographic principle and the computation of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy counting microstates. So, but now I want to try to answer another question. Could be black hole physics relevant also for condensed matter physics? I mean, at first sight, this may be a weird question because it's known that mesoscopic scale, gravity doesn't play any role. No? But to a closer investigation, the answer may be yes. No? At the kinematical level, it's known that since a long time that if you have perturbations in a media, for instance, a fluid, these perturbations see a metric which is not flat, and eventually it may develop horizons. So we may have in this system, some all the phenomenology, let's say, phenomenology of black holes like Hawking radiation. But the answer is also yes at the dynamical level. This is owing to the ADS correspondence, ADS-CFT correspondence, because in the large end limit, you can use this correspondence to deal with strongly coupled quantum field theory just by investigating classical gravity. This, in principle, gives you a method to go beyond the so-called weak coupled quasi-particle paradigm in condensed matter physics. So you can use this holographic method, for instance, to try to tackle problems as non-Fermi liquids and non-high-temperature superconductors. But there is also another reason why this method may be interesting, and this the fact that in this context we have a geometric interpretation of the UV infrared flow in a quantum field theory. So you can start from asymptotically anti de Sitter space times in the UV, and go down to near horizon region, where the geometry may lose some of the isometries. For instance, by breaking the conformal invariance, leaving you just Poincaré invariance. In this case, we get a so-called domain-hole solution. Or you can also break Poincaré invariance, and you get only in the near horizon region a non-relativistic scale theory, a theory in which time and time-like, space-like coordinate scale in a different way. This is the so-called Lifshitz-like solution. Meanwhile, this holographic approach has become very popular. You can see a non-exhaustive list of problems that have been analyzed using this correspondence. And the first is the hydrodynamical limit of strongly coupled QFT, which is here is Giuseppe Policastro, which derived an interesting relation between the shear viscosity, the universal relation between the further ratio of shear viscosity and entropy density. So also transport coefficients in relativistic plasmas, or superconductors, non-Fermi leaks, and so on. But in the following, I will focus on a particular aspect of this particular application, the correspondence, which is the application for the case of Einstein-Maxwell gravity, which is coupled non-minimally with a scalar field. Why is this model important? There are several reasons. The first reason is that it is natural generalization of Einstein-Maxwell gravity, which is covariantly coupled to a scalar, to a charged scalar. This theory gives rise to the holographic superconductors. Another reason is that it has interesting thermodynamical structure. As we'll see, there is a phase transition. It gives rise to a phase transition figured by a neutral scalar condensate. It has a rich phenomenology concerning the transport features of the dual quantum field theory. Another reason is that these non-minimal couplings between U1 and between the U1 field and the scalar field are very natural, very common in supergravity and low energy string theory. Last but not least, this kind of theories allow for background dual Sulli-Fitts theories. So I conclude these introductory remarks with a disclaimer. These do not expect to see an explicit representation of boundary degrees of freedom or even of Hamiltonians describing this boundary degrees of freedom. This is a common limitation, perhaps the most area limitation of this kind of approach, which we basically describe what happens in the boundary theory just by using the bulk theory and nothing more. So we don't have a lot of information. So the rudiments of the DSFT correspondence, what you have in the original formulation, you have a duality, a conjecture duality between Young-Mills theory in D dimensions and theory in a DS background. And this is usually not computationally under control because string theory and curved money and curved space-time is not so easy to take under control, but there is a limit in which the duality becomes more computable, let's say. It is a limit in large N in which you have a duality between gauge theory and semi-classical gravity on anti-DC. Of course, this is much more interesting because you have control of the bulk theory, full control of the bulk theory. And the universal sector of the gravity theory contains, of course, gravity, Einstein gravity, and you can add also other fields on the bulk. For instance, you can add a U1 field, a scalar, Young-Mills fields, what do you want? But the basics, the minimal content is, of course, only gravity. This is gravity onto the theta space time, and the maximally symmetric solution is, of course, under the theta space-time, which is written in Poincaré coordinates. I will use for the TX constant section planar topologies, not spherical topologies. And, of course, we have the isometry group is SOD2, which relies on the boundary as the conformal group in one lesser dimension. The validity of the semi-classical description of the correspondence requires that C, which is the central charge, is much greater than 1. This is the requirement for validity of the approximation. So these are the dual theory. Then we want to compute correlation functions in the theory, and there is here also a recipe which is very, very powerful. And it says that you can just compute endpoint functions for operators in the gauge theory, which are dual to dynamical field on the bulk, just by taking functional derivatives of the effective action of the gravity field. This allows you to compute endpoint functions just by working on bulk quantities. So then you have a correspondence between the scaling dimension of operators and in the or boundary operators in terms of masses. This gives you the relation for a boson and for a fermion. And I mean, this is basically the main structure of the correspondence. I mean, I've been a bit fast, but I mean, this is, I think that most of you have heard about it. So this is everything done at zero temperature. And the most universal deformation away from conformality, of course, if you put in the system a thermal scale. So you put your quantum field theory at fine temperature. On the bulk, this corresponds to consider a black hole at Hawking temperature in the bulk. So you have then identification between thermal states in the boundary with black hole states on the bulk. We can also use the correspondence to calculate some interesting quantities. The most simplest are the free energy, the entropy, and what you get is what you expect to obtain. You obtain that the entropy scales extensively from the point of view of the quantum field theory, but non-extensively, of course, from the point of view of the black hole. This is holographic, so this is nature. Also, the scaling in the temperature and is what expect from conformal invariance. And the coefficients in front of S counts the degrees of freedom of the field. It's a central charge. So this is the basic structure of the holographic ADS-FT correspondence. Now we can try to make the things a bit complicated and add fields on the bulk. The first thing that you can do is just consider on the boundary some finite charge. It means we put on the bulk a Maxwell field. But if you want to generate a phase transition, then we also need a scalar field, charged scalar field that breaks the U1 symmetry of the boundary and gives you the phase transition. So you have Einstein gravity, Maxwell tensor, scalar field covariantly coupled to A and the mass there. So if you want to generate a phase transition, what you need is basically that the operator, the scalar operator O, acquires a non-vanishing vacuum excitation wave. What does it mean from the point of view of the black hole? From the point of view of the black hole, you start from the usual electric charge Reisner-Nordström Zitter solution, which is this, with a scalar field which is identically zero. This is described the unbroken phase. So the U1 symmetry is unbroken. Then, if you can find a solution of these equations in which the black hole, with the same asymptotic Alentejo-Sitter behavior, it means the same Alentejo-Sitter length, and the same charge, electric charge, develops a scalar air, which is called the scalar air, that means a scalar field, which is not anymore constant, but varies on the space-time, then you break the U1 symmetry, and you can have a superconducting phase. This solution has been found. This AD solution has been found, fortunately not analytically, but numerically, by Horowitz and Arknoll and so on. And what you find is that the Rise and Nostrum solution becomes unstable, and from the pictorial description of what happens is the following. In the Rise and Nostrum phase, all the charge, black hole charge, is inside the black hole, and outside is nothing. In the superconducting phase, what happens is that the charge, the scalar field, is distributed, is polarized the space-time. And when the temperature goes below a certain critical temperature, this charge, this polarized space-time, discharged space-time, is energetically preferred with respect to the other phase. You can see also it at a linear level. You can also consider linear perturbations in the scalar field and write the equation for the scalar field in this background. And what you get is that what controls the phase transition is this effective mass. And the effective mass is given by the mass of the scalar minus this term. Now, what happens in the anti-Sitter space-time is that the space, the anti-Sitter space-time itself is unstable if the mass of the scalar field is negative and lesser than this bound, which is known as the Bright-Lona-Friedmann bound. But in any case, what happens is that this effective mass may become lower than this bound, and the space-time solution and the Bright-Lona-Nostrum solution is becomes unstable. So, in some sense, this at a linear level, this instability is due to this contribution to the scalar mass. Sì.
So what does, in which sense is it unstable?
It means that if you start from the Rise-Nostrum of the Sitter space-time, which is anti-Sitter space-time with some charge, as in the charge Q, and when you go down below a certain temperature, it is energetically preferred for the space-time to have a distribution of the charge at scalar field of the outside of the black hole.
So it's not something which happens dynamic. So the space-time evolves from the geometry from
These are static solutions.
I see. So you're comparing different.
Yeah, parameters. I'm comparing static solution. You will see later that. That if you write the free energy for the new configurations at the same temperature and compute the free energy, and we discover that when T is bigger than the critical temperature, the free energy of the Reisner solution is lesser than the GDR. But when we go down below the critical temperature, it happens the opposite. So the free energy of this solution, scalar air, as a free energy which is less than this. This is the interpretation sense. As you have said, the solution are found numerically, and we can find the new solution, in particular the profile of the scalar field, which is this one. This is the stochastic behavior. This is determined by the asymptotic behavior of the scalar field in space-time, and this is the behavior of the electromagnetic field. So this is what you obtain for the. This is the scalar field. Let's say this is the this coefficient here. We have two coefficients, basically we require one of these is B0, and what you remain is this one, and this one is the scalar condensate, interpreted as scalar condensate, and what you see is that above the critical temperature, there is no condensate. So the scalar field is zero, is identical to zero. When you go down the temperature, a scalar condensate forms, and we get this kind of picture. And
near the typical temperature, we get what we expect, that is that the condensate deviates in this way, and this is predicted, was predicted by the mean field, the Oerlikon Landau Weisbrod field. So this is this basically breaks the
U1 symmetry, which is global on the boundary, and we expect now to have a superconductive phase. But to show that this is really superconducting, then you have to compute the conductivity in the boundary. And to do this, we have to use the recipe of the DSFT correspondence. You just perturb the field AX, the Maxwell potential AX in the bulk, and you look for the response in the boundary. And from this response, you can infer the electric conductivity. So you consider usually perturbation with zero spatial momentum and harmonic dependence on time. Then you solve this equation with purely ingoing boundary conditions on the horizon and these asymptotic conditions. And what the DSFT correspondence says is that you can compute the electric field on the X component of the electric field on the boundary. Of course, you can also compute the Epsilon. This is there is homogeneity on the boundary in the X Epsilon direction, so it is relevant. Then this field is given by the leading term in the bulk expansion of AX, whereas the current is given by the subleading term. So at the end we get an expression for the conductivity, which is just this. Then we can numerically integrate this the equation for perturbation and get the conductivity, and the conductivity has this nice behavior, which is typical of superconductors. I mean, we have for omega, this is the conductivity as a function of the frequency, the so-called optical conductivity. When you go for large values of omega, you have an asymptotic behavior, which is determined by the UV behavior of the space-time, which is basically it gives you basically a relativistic dispersion relation. This is rather universal, and then you then go down, we get some behavior of this kind. So how do you see the superconductivity? The superconductivity you see not in this graph, but because because if you have to go to omega equal to zero, and you cannot see from the real part, you have to compute the imaginary part of the conductivity and use Cramer's Kronig relations. That means that what you find is a pole, the first order pole in the imaginary part, and is related by Cramer's Kronig relation for delta function in the real part. This is superconductive. So this is a super the holographic superconductor. Let's now move to the main part. The idea is to consider modification of the previous action. You just consider the Maxwell term coupled to a scalar in non-minimal. This model is parameterized by two coupling functions. This is the coupling functions, non-minimal coupling function f, and the potential. Of course, in this case, the scalar must be neutral, not charged. Of course, we can also consider generalization just by considering psi just as the modulus of some complex field, and add some other terms. Just consider this and this the modulus of the field, and then adding the covariant derivative of a charged field. But I will consider just the minimal case. You can do also this generalized discussion, but I consider just. Of course, because the scalar now is real, we don't expect breaking of the U1 symmetry because we don't have it transforms psi in this case as a scalar under the U1 transformation. So you cannot break the U1 symmetry. So if a phase transition appears, it must be a triggered by some neutral condensate. So, so far we consider just a general form of this complex functions. The only restriction that I will impose is that the theory allows a Reisner-Nostrom to the Sitter black hole solution. In order to do this, the two functions, if you expand the function near psi equals zero, they must start quadratically. So the first derivative must be zero. This is mainly because in the field equations, in order to have a solution of the of field equation with psi identically zero or constant, the derivatives of f and fu in zero must be zero. This is the only constraint that I use. Then you can do the same job that I did before and consider the equation for scalar perturbations, consider the effective mass, and what you get is that the effective mass is the mass of the scalar minus this term, which is very similar to the term that one gets in the case of superconductors. But now, the parameter that controls the transition is not Q, but is this parameter alpha, which is the non-minimal coupling of the theory, which parameterizes the non-minimal coupling of the theory. So in this expansion, what parameterizes the theory is the non-minimal coupling alpha and beta, which is essentially the mass of the scalar field. They are just two parameters. So, this is space dependent. When alpha becomes very, very high, this mass, the effective mass, may become below the BF bound, and this destabilizes the solution, and you have the phase transition. You can see also in a more intuitive way the emergence of phase transition in this way. This mass is radius dependent because this term depends on the radius. So you can see the space-time in this way. You have a region of the space-time where the mass, the effective mass, is below the VF bound, and this gives you the instability. And you have a region of the space-time where the mass is above the VF bound, and this gives you a contribution to stability. The transition between this region is a instability radius, Ri, and if I compare this radius with the horizon radius, I can find a semi-qualitative condition for having phase transition, is that this instability radius must be larger than the horizon radius. This gives you in?
Zero is
the time component of the gauge for temperature tension. It depends on R.
It's not the chemical potential.
No. It's chemical potential is this constant part of A, and the sublinear term gives you basically this goes as 1 over square.
Okay.
So, this gives you a relation between you write an equality between Ri and Rh, and you get, and you formulate this inequality in terms of temperature, and you get this critical temperature, which depends, of course, on alpha and beta. You see very easily that this temperature increases when alpha is bigger, and increases also when beta is closer to this number, to minus this number, which is the BF bound. So this is one way to see the emergence of this instability at linear level, but you can check the presence of this instability in other ways. Another way that you did is just compute the normal modes of the scalar equation, and we found normal modes with imaginary frequencies on the imaginary upper part of the complex plane. This gives the stability, but of course the final proof is at a non-perturbative level, just to integrate numerically the equations. We did it using the shooting method, And we found a solution, compared the free energy of the two, as I explained to you, Luca, and compared the free energy of the two solutions. And the, what, this is what one obtains. This is below the critical temperature, the free energy of the AD solution is less than the free energy of the Reisen-Ostrom solution, and we get the phase transition. This is the specific aim. So we have done this this computation for a lot of our models. Basically, we are considering these models, but in principle, the behavior is rather general. We believe that the behavior is rather general. And actually, what we need to assume is the former the expression that I brought near psi equals zero, and also that near the horizon the coupling function goes to infinity. This, if you assume these two conditions, this behavior is rather general. This is the behavior of the condensate, the scalar condensate as function of temperature. It's very similar to the case of that I showed before for superconductors, for rapid superconductors. These graphs are related for are given for different models. These models are basically cosinus hyperbolicus, cosinus hyperbolic cosines, and power. And power. This is the same for the other operator. This is somehow more tricky. This is for the case in which the coupling function is a power law. And what you get in this case is that the phase transition, the phase space is more bit complicated. We have two branches. This, the upper branch is the stable one, okay, and the lower branch is unstable. So what you get is essentially this this part. So
if I have to put some error bars in the graphs obtained by this integrating this solution, do you have an idea how big are the errors?
No, they are very
smaller than this.
They're small. Some you can do actually in the numerical computation can do as
precise as possible.
Oh, I see. So, I mean, the problem is that you should have to compare it with some other outputs, but if you don't, it's not good. And let's say that at level of importance is quantitative behavior, not the
quantitative.
If I would have some experimental result to compare, then I put there or bus, but at this level it's just qualitative. So this is for the case in which there is a phase transition, but you have also analyzed the case in which there is no phase transition. When is this the case? This is the case when the first derivative of the coupling function evaluated on zero is not zero. In this case, the field equations for the scalar field in a neural background do not allow for the Reisen-Ostrom solution. That means that there is no unbroken phase. The solution is always a solution in which the scalar field is as a non-trivial profile. What you get is this kind of behavior of the scalar condensate, which is similar to the other one. The only tricky point, which I have not really understood, is this. So the behavior of the condensate when the mass of the scalar is very close to the BF bound. So usually one expects that when you go down, that one goes down with the temperature, that the condensate raises. This is mainly because you are lowering the temperature and of course, your excitation tries to sit on the ground state because simply of X of the Gibbs equation. So usually you should have a condensate that increases when the temperature goes down. But when beta is closer to the Gibbs bound, you have this kind of strange situation. So the vacuum is deflected and not I don't. But we didn't really understood what's. What is the physical meaning of this behavior? So let us for what concerns the condensate, the phase transition,
Let's now see what happens to the transport features. So you can analyze the whole system using the same approach that I used before for holographic superconductors. And just to mention that there is another approach is very interesting to compute the conductivities. This is the following. You request the equation for perturbation of AX in terms of a Schrodinger equation. This is very nice. This is a very nice approach. This is the equation for perturbations of AX. You revise this equation in terms of a Schrodinger equation in which a potential appears, and what you can do is relate the conductivity to the reflection coefficients of some of this potential. It's a very nice interpretation. We just take the problem, recast the problem as a particle coming from plus infinity, which scatters on some potential, characterized a field potential, which we can compute exactly from your system. You can compute the reflection coefficients, and when you have the reflection coefficients, you get exactly what you need. This gives you a nice interpretation of the conductivity, and what you get, we can do it either by numerical integration of the equation for the perturbations, or by using this other equation. And what you get at the end get for the conductivity, for the real part of the conductivity, are these graphs. Qualitatively, they are more or less the same. This is the optimal conductivity, how the conductivity behaves for as a function of omega, the frequency. For a big omega, we have the universal behavior that I said before. Then you go down with omega, you find a minimum of the conductivity, which goes down. Then it goes up when you approach zero. And the nice thing is that when you go exactly to zero, the value of the conductivity is not zero, but are given by these points. And what you also can note is that the value at omega equals zero increases with the value of the non-minimal coupling parameter. R is alpha squared, so if you have a bigger alpha, you get a bigger value. And the depth of the minimum increases when the temperature goes down. Also, we have the same, more or less the same quantitative behavior. Again, in the case when you have power law coupling functions, you have some strange behavior, which I really didn't understand. Then you have some sharp peaks, not only a minimum and a small maximum, but a lot of sharp peaks, which really, again, you understand very well who's the origin of this.
Isn't this counterintuitive? Because at zero frequency, in the coupling with the gauge field disappears.
No, the coupling with gauge fields is the coupling alpha, the minimal coupling is always there. Why do you mean this?
Yeah, no. Okay, I was thinking it's coupled to the strength. So
no, it couples. I mean the perturbations, the equation for the scalar perturbation indeed as I cannot show it. Okay, this is more or less the recasting of the equation of the scalar perturbation in terms of as a Schrodinger equation. What you have is a term, which is, let's say, the same that you get when you have a minimal coupling between the gauge field and the scalar, which is this. And what is new when you have a non-minimal coupling is that here. And what you can show is that this is always positive definite. That's its obvious. But this one is negative. So what happens? That in the case of holographic superconductors, you have
that the barrier, you cannot create the barrier. When you go down to with omega, which is essentially the energy, the reflection coefficient becomes basically 1 and the conductivity becomes 0. Okay? But here, owing to this negative term, what you get is that the effective potential can become negative. So when we go to omega equals 0, it may have some sort of resonance. And the explanation of the fact that you have at omega equals 0, a difference from 0 or behavior is because of this. What I have also to say is that, as I will say later, that this holds only in the case of finite temperature. When you go to zero, and as you shall see later, in the zero temperature limit, what happens? It's very different because this is more or less it describes more or less the back reaction of the geometry, and this describes the nominal coupling. When the temperature is not so close to zero, this term dominates. And you have this kind of behavior. When the temperature is zero, the back reaction dominates, and what you get is that now the conductivity scales as a power of omega. It means it goes to zero when omega goes to zero. So this kind of behavior is just typical of the finite temperature. When you go to the zero temperature limit, what you get is that the thing that still dominates. So what you get, it's important that at omega equals zero you have a value of the conductivity which is not zero, because this is a reminiscent of a well-known effect for the transport properties of electrons. This is the Drude equation, which actually was written by Drude at the beginning of the last century, just by using gas, fermion gas picture, without using also Fermi-Dirac statistics, just a very simple model of electrons. And he brought this equation, where tau is just a relaxation time due to electron-electron scattering. And what you get is that for omega equals zero, we have residual conductivity. So, as I explained before, the appearance of this Drude peak for ordinary metals can be understood in terms of this effective potential. And another important point is the dependence of the conductivity from the temperature. This was the dependence from the frequency. Let's now consider the dependence of the temperature. So let's say that dc conductivity, let us take that dc conductivity, it means the conductivity at omega equals zero, and investigate that is its dependence from the temperature. What you find is again a non-monotonic behavior. So for bigger values of the temperature, and if you start from high values of the temperature and you go down, what you get is that the conductivity increases, and it is what we expect for an ordinary metal. But then, when the temperature goes below a certain value, you see that it goes down. The conductivity goes down. So the difference of this minimum, it's also a very well-known effect in condensed matter physics, in case of metals with impurities, magnetic impurities, and it's due to the interaction of these conductive electrons with the magnetic moment of the impurities, the so-called Condor effect. We have also made a step forward and tried to match, make a fit of this course. And we found a very, very nice agreement of this curves with this behavior of the resistive. Now the agreement now is there is zero bars, and this the agreement is about 5%, which is actually very good.
Now what you see is the following. Forget the last term. These terms are exactly what you expect for a normal metal. The first term is the residual resistivity. This term describes electron-electron scattering, and this one is just the Kondo effect. So this describes the first part, this part of the graph. But then, at slow temperature, we have this new term, which has no counterpart in the case of real metals, ordinary metals. The exponent here is negative. It's positive. And what you get is that when you go to small values of temperature, the conductivity goes again down. That is, at small temperature, we have a repulsive effect, which is of course not seen in ordinary metals. And the non-monotonic behavior of this curve is just due to interplay of a behavior at final temperature, which is described from, let's say, by ordinary metal behavior, and the small t behavior, which is determined by this force term. I will come to this term when I discuss the t equals zero limit. Okay, let us now go to the t equals zero limit. And this is equal to zero limit. We have basically extremal black hole, near extremal black hole. And we can, in this limit, we can find the solutions, at least the leading term of the solutions analytically. Now, when one uses this parameterization of the solution, then looks for the leading term of the solution. And what one finds is the following. The metric has a Lipschitz form. Lipschitz form means that the dysfunctions in the metric scale as a power with exponent determined by the parameters appearing in the potential in the coupling function. This is the case of when the potential or f behaves exponentially in the near horizon region. This is the rather general behavior when these two functions behave exponentially. On the other hand, if the coupling function, the potential behave as a power law, what you get, you get the logarithmic behavior near the mass. So from this behavior, we can, using the Schrödinger equation picture, we can compute the conductivities. What happens actually is that the behavior at small omega of the conductivity, or small t, which is the same as small t, is determined by the behavior of the Schrödinger potential near the horizon. So it doesn't matter how the potential behaves on the asymptotic region. What determines the behavior of the conductivities is just the asymptotic behavior of the potential at the horizon, which actually is located at z, in these coordinates, is located at z equal minus infinity. So then you can calculate the reflection potential, the reflection coefficients, use the formula that I wrote before, and what you get is this behavior of the conductivities. It scales as a power of omega. Well, the exponent s is determined by the parameter of the potential, and is bigger or equal than 2. As I said before, now, when omega goes to 0, the conductivity goes to 0. Same behavior of the of the DC conductivity as function of temperature, again scales as a power of S.
And the explanation in terms of the thing potential in the Schrodinger equation is obvious. When you go to zero temperature, the back reaction of the metric dominates with respect to the part due to the nonminimal coupling, and because this part is positive, the part of the reaction is the positive definite. You have a barrier which is positive, you don't have a negative part. The reflection coefficient is 1, and you have that sigma this is 0 must be 0. So the same can do this. This was for a potential which behaves near the horizon exponential. If you have a potential, potential that behaves near the horizon as a power law, we get the same expression for the asymptotic behavior of the thin potential. But now the C, which determines basically the exponents, is equal to two. And what you get is a quadratic behavior of the conductivity. But the DC conductivity as a function of temperature is more complicated. You have some logarithmic correction. And the reason is that in order to pass from the from this to this, we have to use the relation between the horizon radius and the temperature. In this case of logarithmic behaving matrix, this relation is rather complicated. This is why the relation now has t square term, but subleading corrected by these local terms. So what work is nice, because I think it's nice, is that even though in the case of this power law or coupling functions, which have you seen, the matrix is not merely Lipschitz. Usually one is led to think that this scaling behavior of the conductivities are related to some sort of non-relativistic scaling symmetry of the matrix. But we have found, it's very puzzling, that also when this scaling isometry of the matrix are broken, because now the matrix behaves as a logarithmic, still that the real part of the conductivity scales as a power of omega, but the DC conductivity as a function of t gets this this logarithmic correction. So this is what about the case of electrically charged black holes. We have also generalized this this description to the ionic black holes. That means black holes with a magnetic field, both magnetic and electric charge. Basically, I have no time to enter into details. I'll give you what are the main features. We have basically almost the same picture that we get in the case of the electric charge black hole. Here a list of the new features. So what we have now is a magnetic field in the bulk which is perpendicular to the XY plane. Because the boundary is just the X is in the Y direction, on the boundary what you get is a magnetic field, external magnetic field, perpendicular to the boundary. So from the quantum field point of view, you have a QFT with an external magnetic field pointing perpendicular to the X Y direction. What is new with respect to the previous case is the following. The first feature is that now there is a critical value of the magnetic field above which the phase transition does occur. The reason is very simple. In the expression for the square mass, for the square mass, the negative term is proportional to the electric charge, but the negative there is a positive term, which is proportional to the magnetic charge. So if you work at fixed electric charge, there is a value
of the magnetization, for which the mass of the scalar becomes above the VF bound, and there is basically no phase transition. So in some sense, this is an effect which is an inverse Meissner effect. Other feature is that now the perturbations, I haven't mentioned at this point, but when you consider the electric case, perturbation of the electric potential AX is decoupled from basically from everything else. It couples just to the TX component of the metric, but the equation can be solved, and basically we get just a self-consistent equation for AX. In the case of a magnetic field, this is not so. And what we get is a coupling between the AX component of the field and the epsilon component. This is also self-evident, because now we have a component of the AX in the epsilon direction. So they get mixed in the field. So this makes calculation more complicated, but not impossible to do, at least numerically. Now, the conductivity matrix now, of course, is a matrix, because we have conductivities in the x and y direction. And what you get a pole in this matrix corresponding to damped cyclotron frequencies. And in the omega equals zero limit, we get that sigma xx and also sigma xy equals zero, whereas the xy conductivity is given by the ratio between the charge, the electric charge, and the magnetic field, basically the whole conductivity. We can also compute the magnetic susceptibility, and we find that this order one is positive, so we have a strongly diamagnetic case. So let me jump to the conclusion. So these are basically these properties of holographic, these holographic properties of charged electronic black holes are rather general. They seem not to depend by the particular form of the couplings, the two couplings, the function, the non-minimal coupling F and the potential, and the scalar potential V. Although we haven't found the general theorem stating that the behavior is quite the same, we have the strong feeling that indeed this qualitative behavior is largely independent of the form of this function, as far as you impose this condition that I mentioned, that the potential starts quadratically and the coupling function starts quadratically, if you want to have a phase transition. If not, they don't start quadratically, then you don't have phase transition, but you have, in any case, this the behaviors of the conductivity. So the parameter that controls, in some sense, the behavior of the phase transition is the value of the first derivative of the coupling function in zero. Then if you have the derivative equal zero, then you have basically a phase transition. If not, if it's different from zero, then you don't have. Of course, the quantitative behavior of the conductivities do depend on the parameters of the potential, but the qualitative behavior is almost the same. In the zero temperature limit, we have, in some sense, a universal behavior. So we have seen that all the conductivities behave as a function of omega, behave in a power law way. So they behave as a power law. The same is true for the conductivity, for the C conductivity as a function of the temperature, but now this is strictly true only when you have coupling functions which behave exponentially near the horizon, but when you have coupling functions which behave as a power law near the horizon, we have some logarithmic corrections. So the whole holographic picture that emerges from all this discussion is the following. We have some behavior of the transport fixtures of the dual quantum field theory at finite temperature, which is reminiscent, very similar to what happens in the case of ordinary metals. with this this behavior. But when you go and consider the zero temperature limit, we have some repulsive behavior of the conductivities. And what has been speculated by Kakru and others is that this behavior is related to a charged plasma, repulsive charge description of this limit. But in this limit, we have, let's say, some universality in the sense that all the transport coefficients, at least this, the conductivities, behave in this at this universal behavior. I conclude my talk by coming back to the intrinsic limitation of this kind of approach. I mean, of course, everything that I said has been derived just from bulk properties. So I haven't said anything about bounded degrees of freedom. So the relevant question is, what are these bounded degrees of freedom? This is really the most strong limitation of this kind of holographic approach. Unless we start from a well-defined theory, for instance, when you know exactly what the dual CFT is, as in the case of the Maldacena conjecture, when you can say that the dual theory is n equal 4 super young Mills in four dimensions. In this case, when you use a Laplacian limit, you don't know exactly with what we are dealing. So the basic question is, these features seem very nice, seem to have something behind, something fundamental behind, but unless you are able to describe the degrees of freedom in an explicit way of the boundary theory, and you have an explicit description of this boundary, degrees of freedom, I think it's not going to have very... It can go so far away and along this direction. Thank you very much.
Okay, questions? Just one question. So you said that the integration of the behavior of conductivity with respect to frequency, mm-hmm. there was the strange behavior. Mm-hmm. And
it
goes up. And, yeah. Is it strange also from the gravitation?
From the gravitational point of view, what you get is this these solutions. We have to say that all these solutions are we have not analytical control of them. They are just numerically deriving. But what you see when you derive this solution is that there is that the relationship between radius and temperature is not one-to-one. That is why you have these different branches. You have different branches of solutions, and one of these branches is stable, the other one is unstable. This concerns the scalar condensate. When you compute the conductivity, then you have this these peaks in the conductivity. But to what bulk physics are they related? I mean, more than that, I don't understand. This is somehow, it seems that there's some maybe there's some resonance in the dual theory, but as I said, because of this, this point, it's very difficult to. I think that one thing that you can do is using this Schrödinger description. This gives you more information because from the properties, because the Schrödinger equation, when you compute the reflection coefficients from the properties of the potential, you can infer a lot of things. Then you have some insight if you rewrite the equation for the conductivities in terms of the Schrödinger equation. This helps a lot, but it doesn't give the final answer on the point.
Thank you. Again.